And welcome to Speaking Volumes, the radio book group for everyone who enjoys reading and talking about books. We are a production of Audio Journal. This program is funded in part by the Greater Worcester Community Foundation and by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome, and if you're one of our regular members, welcome back. Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goals of informing and entertaining. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinion of Audio Journal, its board of directors, or staff. The opinions are ours alone. There are going to be five of us gathered in the studio tonight. I'd like to welcome Tracy Lanier and Carla McCullough. We're expecting Susan and Steve Robsky to join us soon. My name is Carol Sarafkhan, and our book tonight is Leave the World Behind by Rumaan Alam. I hope you'll join the conversation, too. The phone number to call is 508-373-2343. I'll repeat that again, 508-373-2343. Feel free to jump in with a phone call anytime. I'm going to begin by reading a summary of the book, and then we'll share our impressions and launch into our discussion. Leave the World Behind by Rumaan Alam. The story centers on Amanda and Clay, who take their teenage children, Rose and Archie, to a luxurious but isolated Airbnb on Long Island for a summer vacation. Their idyllic retreat is interrupted when the owners, G.H. and Ruth Washington, arrive unexpectedly, claiming that a blackout has occurred in New York City. Initially suspicious of the couple, Amanda's apprehensions are heightened by the strange occurrences around them, including the malfunctioning of their technology. As the family tries to maintain a sense of normalcy, they face increasing anxiety about the outside world. Clay attempts to venture into town to gather information, but becomes lost while Amanda grapples with her growing fears and the unsettling atmosphere. The situation escalates when a loud, unidentifiable noise shatters their sense of security, leading to panic among the characters. Well, Stacy, why don't you give us your thoughts about this book?
Well, given the state of affairs in our world the last couple of weeks, I found this incredibly disturbing, just because of the subject matter. I just couldn't get past being preoccupied with the sort of what-ifs of the book and of the situation that we're in. With that said, I'm kind of ambivalent about this book. It's a great premise, but there were just so many places that seemed awkward to me in the book. It just didn't seem to go that smoothly, and the story, though a good story, seemed like the author had to force certain things, and so that left me feeling like it was a little stilted.
Well, Carla, what were your thoughts?
This book unsettled me, but in a good way. Sometimes books that you find disturbing, they stay with you even more so than the books that were so nice and pleasant, and then you forget about it 1 week later. So this book was unsettling. It made me tense. It made me anxious. And I love, Stacy, that you used the word awkward, because the conversations made me uncomfortable in this book. It wasn't even during action parts, but just the dialogues made me... Dialogues. I should say the dueling monologues where the people were just posturing. It made me uncomfortable the way these characters even interacted. So,
Susan, do you want to share your thoughts? Welcome.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't really care for the book, but it was certainly very timely considering things going on in the world right now. And, yeah, I found the book very awkward was a good thing. I thought the author was quite lazy in many ways in terms of the dialogue, in terms of the plotting, just leaving, saying things and then just sort of dropping them on the floor. And I, too, found the... Well, I found the characters not particularly likable.
Yes.
Yeah.
I found them unrelatable. I did think that some of the descriptions, like, of the kids, I thought were right on, were spot on, the teenage things. So I did think there were some good points. In terms of the plotting, I felt he could have done a much... I think it's a he.
Yes.
I think he could have done a much better job. And I thought he had an opportunity and let it go.
Mm-hmm. I found myself that I was really engaged with this book when I was reading it, but also when between reads, I was thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't always happen. You know, sometimes you can put down a book and not think about it till the next time you pick it up. But with this book, I was thinking about it. I was telling my husband about it in between. And so I give the author credit for that, for keeping me involved in it. I was interested that the book, the first part of the book, is there are funny parts. You know, it's kind of humorous, and he does a lot of witty wordplay and things like that. But then things, when the action starts, things really change, and you don't get those little witty descriptions of, almost satirical descriptions of things. Steve, what were your thoughts about this?
I did not love this book. Mm. I could not find anybody in the book that I could associate with. I thought Amanda was the definition of a Karen. And I thought the author gave away too much too early. I think we're supposed to assume, I'm sorry, that's better. I think we're supposed to assume that there was an atomic bomb dropped in New York City. And yeah, that would be great, but it could also have been Amanda's paranoia. The world around is all crazy. And okay, the televisions are down, but... by halfway through the book or so, we knew what it was, except he never actually said. And just, I thought he wasted a chance for some suspense in the book also. So.
Yeah, I think he gave it away too soon. I think, you know, I said before that when Archie's teeth started to fall out, I was like, okay, he's got radiation sickness. Mm-hmm. Here's what has happened. And I was definitely disappointed to have figured it out so soon.
Mm. That's interesting. It, what you figured it out. My reading history of my dystopian novels, I did not go to atomic bomb and radiation poisoning. I was like, oh, this is definitely either aliens or something other that is happening. And why are there flamingos here? So I was totally thinking that this was like otherworldly invasions.
I did love the flamingos. Oh, that was a really nice touch.
That
I
really
thought.
Was.
And the deer, the thousands of deer all, they knew something and they were
escaping.
Presumably leaving Long Island. I don't know for sure.
I thought they were escaping from a zoo or something.
But I did like that.
But if you know Long Island, they're running to the end of the island.
Is that what they're doing? Are they running the wrong way?
The wrong way? The wrong way. They were going east.
Hmm. Well, didn't and say we, they were smart I, deer.
They never quite said, but I assume we were in Southampton.
Yeah, something like that.
And I don't know Southampton that well. I had an aunt who lived there for a number of years. And I don't think there are too many places where there's a quarter of a mile of woods between houses.
That's something that I was thinking about, too, because I mean, I don't know Long Island well, but it's not the setting I would expect for people mm-hmm. to be in an isolated area.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and in fact, I'm not. They felt isolated because the GPS, you know, you were too far from cell towers or something. The GPS mm-hmm. and their phones were spotty or didn't work. But there were other houses around. Rose walked to one,
right, yeah, as it turned out. Yeah,
and the fact that they didn't make any attempt to like walk to some of these houses and knock on the door and say, "Hey, are you having something weird going on?"
Yeah,
that was not believable yeah. to me.
But that the Washingtons. How long had they been there? They'd been there a while.
Yeah. Right?
They didn't know any of the neighbors. They didn't even seem to know that they existed.
Yeah, it's
that there were neighbors.
Weird.
It was like a self-isolation.
But and again, given the relative wealth of that area, there is no way there would not be GPS and cell towers available.
Mm. And police patrolling.
Right. You would have thought that if something bad had happened, there would be police or first responders out there
doing
checking
something.
On people.
Yeah. I guess we presume they're, I don't know. I'm going to say they're all dead, but nobody was dead that we know of in that area,
in that area.
Right?
Right?
We didn't.
With the husband, Clay, going out to try and get some information in mm. town and him getting lost and so turned around and not able to understand the maid, even though she was speaking Spanish or whatnot, that seemed otherworldly to me. No, like, did you have, like, an explanation for that? Or, again, I don't know why my brain went to dystopian.
I just thought that was another bit of awkwardness.
Okay.
Except that he lives in Brooklyn. Clay lives in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And I doubt there's anybody who lives in Brooklyn who can't speak some part of Spanish.
He just seemed confounded, like unnaturally or unreasonably so.
Well, he was panicked.
He was.
He sure. was. And she was.
They were both panicked. Yeah, I don't think that leads to good communication.
There was not good communication in this whole book. It was making me very upset.
And it did seem, it just seemed odd that that was the only person that anyone encountered.
Mm.
I wanted to bring your attention to when the first knock comes on the door.
Mm.
Amanda held up her hand to silence him. I know I heard something. There it was, undeniable noise, a cough, a voice, a step, a hesitation, that uncategorizable animal knowledge that there's another of the species nearby, and the pause, pregnant, to see if they mean harm. There was a knock at the door, a knock at the door of this house where no one knew they were, not even the global positioning system, this house near the ocean, but also lost in farmland, this house of red bricks painted white, the very material the smartest little piggy chose because it would keep him safest. There was a knock at the door. First of all, I love the this little piggy part. This is one of the last places I think he puts some humor in, where, you know, we're just getting to the action here. But I wanted to know, did he adequately build the environment so that you were nervous about a knock at the door?
No. I was like, what is wrong with her?
Yeah.
Somebody knocked on your door. Why don't you say...
She had seemed flaky enough before that that I thought...
I might think, maybe it's a neighbor coming to say hi, or
somebody's car broke down.
Or, you know, that my mind would not instantly jump to someone's coming to murder us and, you know, assault my daughter in her bed.
Also, there's a storm brewing, so, I mean, I could imagine someone's car breaks down, they come knock on your... I was surprised at her anxiety about it, and I thought, is he trying to say city mouse, country mouse? You know, she's a city girl, and just being
out in the middle of nowhere, which she thought she wanted for vacation, is making her so anxious.
Maybe.
But she doesn't let up either. I mean, they come in, and, I mean, 20 pages later, she's saying, why did you tell them they could stay? You know, she's mad at her husband. And Clay thought it was perfectly obvious. There had been a blackout. They got scared. They're old. He whispered this, felt that it was disrespectful to point out. They're strangers, she said, like he was an idiot. Had no one ever warned Clay about strangers? Well, they introduced themselves. They just knocked on the door in the middle of the night. Amanda could not believe they were discussing this.
Well, you know, it. I mean, what's unspoken there is they're black.
Yes. She goes on to speak it right out loud.
Right. That was feeding her anxiety. And that was also, that was interesting that we all knew it was because they were black and they couldn't, you know, she and Clay couldn't believe that they could own this beautiful house as a second home. And so she was pretty awkward at that point.
I think it must be because I'm such a nervous person that I was tense when the knock came. But because how many conversational turns did it take for them to actually say why they were there? Was it three or four times? Sorry to bother you. Oh, we didn't want to make you nervous. Again, again, again. And I was yelling at the book, why are you there? Just say it, spit it out. You know, so that was what was making me anxious. Why are they beating around the bush? It was making me suspicious, but I think it was because they were black and like, please don't have negative connotations.
Don't pull out your gun and shoot me before I get a chance to.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I was thinking about how my husband and I would, my husband would have offered them the master bedroom. I mean, he would have invited them right in and offered to move out.
I'd offer him the sofa, but Steve would offer him the...
If they needed the house back. I mean, I'm interested to know that that seemed funny to the rest of you also.
They didn't have that human connection of, these poor people.
No, they didn't, not at all.
They just saw them as intruders.
And how dare they ruin their vacation.
Yeah. Right. And this was the first night, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it wasn't, they hadn't really even
established
themselves.
They swam in the pool once.
They hadn't, you know.
Such ownership.
Because I can see how after, you know, if you're in a place for a couple of days, even a week, it starts to be like yours. And if other people come, you feel invaded. But they hadn't even had an opportunity to do that, to be.
I had written down that phrase. They were paying for the illusion of ownership. You know, well, you don't own it. Give them back their bedrooms.
One of the parts of the book that I think the author did not handle smoothly was the racial piece of it. He introduced it right here at the beginning. He gives us these four adults, two are black and two are white. But he doesn't, I don't think he followed that through to anything. It might interest you to know that the author is black. I don't know if you knew that, but he is. But he put the racial element in there, and you could say again with the Spanish-speaking woman he encountered on the road. He put it in a second time, and neither time did he really play it forward,
right.
I guess.
It was like he introduced it, and it was kind of a major point at that when he introduced it, and then it went away.
Yeah. I mean, if you met someone like that, wouldn't you, I don't know, say, can I take you back? Can we go do something? Can we go back to your house or, you know, find out what's wrong?
Can you help me find my house?
Help me find my house? Not just leave her there standing in the road. That was just so
awful,
so wrong. Even if he couldn't speak to her, just to, I don't know, I would try to do something.
The other part that I had trouble with was the Clay's venture to go get some information, and I thought it was about time somebody did that. But George, didn't go with him.
Oh, G.H., yeah.
Didn't go with him. And he knows how to get to the village. He knows how to get information.
Why but his wife wouldn't let him go, right?
Yeah, that was the premise. I mean, that's what the author tells us, that the wife wouldn't get.
I couldn't swallow it. Just because she was nervous, he didn't go.
Yeah, and I guess he sketched out a little map or something. Right. I don't know, but an inadequate map.
Right, and then anyway. He was daydreaming as he was driving, right? He was just not really paying attention, and all of a sudden he was lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, I think one interesting thing is the name Clay. Does Clay imply strength?
No.
Does Clay imply anything other than crushability?
Malleable.
And, of course, Amanda, the wife, I don't think that's accidental.
That's interesting. I didn't take that into account. But there was a whole lot of toxic masculinity and posturing for position because you've got, you know, not only the race card, but then there was also the finances where owners were, in fact, like, you know, upper echelon compared to these renters. And so when G.H. and Amanda were out in the pool, which would you be naked in front of this complete stranger in a hot tub? No, I would not be. But they were just, again, with the monologuing and like, I do this for work. And he, like, you know, even G.H. was not a likable character, just kind of talking all about, like, you know, his money and finances and whatnot. There was such a disconnection interpersonally, like, just from the world. Like, would you fall apart so much if you were cut off from technology? Because they did. They crumpled. And he said, Clay said, I can't do anything without my phone. I feel so useless. He was no longer a man that could take action and G.H. couldn't take action without information. It was just interesting. Yeah. Yes. All that posturing led to nothing.
I'm going to read a little excerpt again. This is when the noise happens for the first time. She was sitting there, not doing anything more when it happened, when there was something, a noise, but that didn't cover it. Noise was an insufficient noun, or maybe noise was always impossible to describe in words. What was music but noise? Could words get at Beethoven? This was a noise, yes, but one so loud that it was almost a physical presence, so sudden because, of course, there was no precedent. There was nothing left. There was nothing, real life, and then there was noise. Of course, they'd never heard a noise like that before. You didn't hear such a noise. You experienced it, endured it, survived it, witnessed it. You could fairly say that their lives could be divided into two, the period before they heard that noise and the period after. It was a noise, but it was a transformation. It was a noise, but it was a confirmation. Something had happened. Something was happening. It was ongoing. The noise was confirmation, even as the noise was mystery. Well, he had me there. Mm-hmm. I was completely wrapped up in the terror of the noise and the experience of the noise.
If the noise was an atomic bomb going off, there would have been a flash of light. 10 minutes before, this guy would have just blown up. Look, it's only 50 miles away.
We don't have to be realistic.
I was not at all sure what was going on. I wasn't thinking atomic bomb. I was right with the author here. He's describing something that is completely outside of my experience.
I didn't get it there, except that something, what it meant was something bad is happening.
Like aliens.
It could have been aliens, you know. How big was it? It could have been, you know, the entire electrical system blowing up or
and there would have been an incredible overpressure.
Don't be realistic.
So you were already
kind of nuclear
by
bomb.
This point in the book, you were already sure it was a nuclear explosion?
Not necessarily sure, but That was certainly what was first on my mind.
Hmm. But it was odd about, wasn't it odd that the electricity never went down the entire time?
Yeah, I think that was necessary for the story to continue as it did, right? They couldn't let the electricity go, or the author couldn't turn off the electricity.
Yeah, because they kept acting like everything was okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know about you guys, but every time there's a snowstorm, I say, I just hope we don't lose power. You know, if we don't lose power, I'll settle in here with a book and a cup of tea. I'll do some of my sewing, as long as we don't lose power. That's my mantra. So I was with them there. Oh, good. Well, we haven't lost power.
Haven't lost power.
You know, how bad can it be? We still have power.
Yeah.
And they just... they wanted to cocoon inside. Certainly, the owners, her name was Ruth.
Right.
She felt safe there, and she wanted to stay inside. She didn't want him to go out anyplace. Right. That was her response to fear.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
I think a lot of us feel
in your little hobbit hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We'll just stay here. It'll all blow over. And
why did they never just talk about it? Why did they never say to each other,
"What's going on?
What was that noise? What was that subsequent noise? What is going on here? What could it be?" They didn't speculate.
No.
That seemed kind of unnatural.
Too big, too scary, too...
But again, if you look at the characters, at least three of them had an over-ability to communicate. Clay was the professor. Amanda was public relations something. Of course, the wealthy investor. Do we know what Ruth did? Other than just be with George?
Well, she had worked in admissions at a private school.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's
remember,
right.
Amanda sort of jumped on that mentally, like, oh.
Yeah, now I'll be nice to you if I can get something out of it.
But they, they were all perfectly capable of communication.
And they didn't talk to the kids as though they were somehow protecting the kids. If they had... they would have known about the deer much earlier on because Rose knew about those.
Right. Mm. Yeah, they weren't so young to be sent to bed like that and whatnot, too. Yeah, I thought they were a little bit too old to be that level of sheltered. I agree. Yeah.
And the kids, like, didn't pester them with questions the way I think, in my experience, teenagers can be relentless in asking what's going on.
Yeah. What's going on and what are you going to do about it? I did think it fit that the whole family, including the kids, all went to bed together in the same bed.
Yes.
I thought, that part is true. Just wanting to be sure we're all together and we're all safe. And
I did like that.
Back to your point, Carol, about nesting and closing in. We had a snowstorm about 30 years ago.
Probably.
And we lost power. And we have have a wood stove and we have a lantern. We're camp.
Yeah.
And we just had a very pleasant day. My son and I had to pull our way out through a couple feet of snow to get to the firewood pile and bring firewood in. And it came nighttime, and we all brought our sleeping bags down, all their heads at the wood stove. And then the power came on. And the first thing I heard was the filter on the fish tank.
Uh-huh.
And just all these other, the refrigerator coming on, all these other noises that you live with. That
you don't even notice.
You don't even notice.
And were you a little disappointed when it came on?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you had made your little camp there.
Yeah,
you were ready.
We were warm. We had food.
You hadn't heard any big noises.
No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But he kind of threw things out there, like it was Archie was running through the woods, and he didn't even notice the tick bite.
That was weird. What was that tick all? Yeah.
And then so when they started to feel sick, I was thinking, it was very quick, but it was also very quick for radiation sickness.
Yes.
you know, things like that don't usually happen that quickly, but did he get sick because he had some sort of disease from the tick? It just never gets mentioned again.
Mm. And in fact, way back at the beginning, when they first arrive at the house, Amanda sees all the trees and she's a little nervous about Lyme disease. So they've even planted that idea that ticks on Long Island aren't particularly good things to have.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but he just drops it then. Yeah. So maybe it's a red herring. Maybe he did that intentionally.
Usually in these disaster type of movies, you'll see something leading up to the cataclysmic event, or you'll see the after effects of it the day after, so to speak. But this one, not knowing of it, to me, made me more tense because I really did not think that this was a man-made thing. I didn't know. I didn't know what was going on, and all the incongruities that were going on made me think other, that this is something I can't explain. It's unexplainable. So that made me more nervous. Every once in a while, though, that omniscient narrator would throw out something like, the person who died in the elevator. I'm like, I didn't want to know that. You know, you'll get these little glimpses from the outside world, which was really interesting, too.
That was kind of disconcerting because I was thinking otherwise he might want you to be in the position that they were in, right? You have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
You're out here in Long Island. You just don't know.
I wonder why he did that.
But then he keeps throwing these bones, I don't know, so that you do know, oh, the president is right now under the...
In a bunker.
So you go, oh, okay, this is much bigger than Long Island, and this is happening, and that's happening, and little do we know that these guys are in their planes flying over. It's like...
Yeah.
So it's like he didn't quite... I felt like he didn't quite know what he wanted the story to be.
Or was it on purpose that, like, I want to keep you unsettled and not knowing? I guess I think the best of him, like, he had this all planned out.
Yes.
He knew that he was going to leave us, like, just wondering and scratching our heads as
to
what this could be.
The other episode I'd like to talk about is when Clay and George do go out together, and Ruth makes them promise they won't be gone for more than an hour, and they're... because they're going to take Archie to the hospital. They're going to have somebody look at him and find out what's going on. And George insists they make a detour to go to his contractor's house.
To see Danny.
What did you think of that?
Well, first I thought the promise I'll be back in an hour was incredibly stupid, because what is she going to do if he's not back in an hour?
Right, and like, who goes to the emergency room and comes back in an hour?
Right.
No one.
We can speak to that. We were there for 10 hours.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but they could have just dropped him, like people do that, right? Drop him, throw him out of the car and drive away.
But why was Archie the only one suffering from radiation sickness?
Yeah, that would be a good question, too.
Nobody was shielded. The Washingtons could have been downstairs in the in-law apartment, which would have given them some shielding. Mm. But everybody else was in the house or outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why is it just Archie? Yes, I think Sue mentioned that your teeth don't fall out in a matter of hours.
I was really interested in the relationship that George thought he had with Danny.
With Danny, yeah.
He thought that they were friends, and I could imagine this wealthy guy really admires the man with the concrete skills who really knows how to build stuff, do real stuff. And they've worked together on building this house just the way they want it. And he thinks they're friends. And he gets there, and Danny's not happy that he's there. And they're not friends. He
not
worked for him.
Yeah.
Right,
he's nice
to
him because he worked for him and he wanted the job and he, wants more jobs. But it stops right there at his doorway. He's not letting them in. And then we also get Danny picture of a little bit of a survivalist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here. I've got my family. I've got my guns. I don't remember what else he said he had, a generator or food put by or something. And
I'm going to stay here, and I suggest you go back home and stay there.
Go back home. Yeah.
And it was mentioned throughout the book, like how much he held that Danny in high esteem, like
yes.
how he would know what to do. And we have to.
Yes.
And so George was such a man of information. We need information before we can have an action plan. But Danny was someone with a different type of intelligence, you know, like with that mechanical intelligence. And yet he held him in. It's so just, it was interesting, I thought, that
well,
he held
I
him
did
in
too.
Regard.
I thought that was an interesting episode
it was
there.
Kind of indicative of a kind of a typical class reaction, you know, that I think that wealthy people who hire people and then the people who work for them, of course, feel obligated to be very nice and to mm-hmm. act like they are friends, even when they know, I mean, you know that I'm working for this person, and, you know, all this friendliness could come to an end
mm-hmm.
right away.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I thought that was a good, that actually worked pretty well.
I mm-hmm. thought so, too. And Danny represented the pragmatist who mm-hmm. was, you know, at least trying to do something about it, even if it was, you know, stock up his guns and get
yeah.
ready for what came. He did not seem to have Steve's awareness of what was going on.
Well, he had gone into town and gotten food and stuff to prepare.
Yeah.
But he was the only one at the grocery store. Mm. He said there was nobody there. I thought it was going to be like a snowstorm coming. Mm-hmm. Where everybody would be stocking up.
That was interesting. Like, where is everyone?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why is everyone hunkering down in their houses?
And Ruth and George, it's mentioned, one thing that reassures them is that they know in the safe they have $10,000.
Mm.
Well, I don't know what they think they're going to buy with that, but that's their sense of security.
Right.
Danny's got guns. They've got $10,000.
They think that money is going to get them what they need.
Yeah.
And Danny also says, I didn't mark this passage in the book, but didn't you see the signs? Didn't you know this was coming?
That. No, I didn't. I missed that.
Well, haven't you been paying attention to Iran? Haven't you? It's interesting.
Steve mentioned that, yes.
Ironic.
Yeah. That he knew there were trouble spots, that the world was closer to the brink than the other four of them ever had any idea it was.
Yeah, you know, they must have been not paying any attention at all, because they didn't go there at any point.
Hmm. Oh dear.
And they were so easily influenced by this discussion with Danny that they didn't pursue the hospital. They didn't go into town to try to see if anybody there did have more information.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. Go to the hospital, see if anyone's there. See if the hospital is running. You know, just find out how long would it take. You know, go into town, see if the police station's open, see if...
The only one that kind of followed through with the plan of action was the little girl, like, saying, well, I'm going to go to the house and I'll find that and we'll see if there's people there and we can get... And then even when there wasn't, well, I can gather up these goods and this can help us out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like,
and, my family can move here and Archie can have this room. And,
She was the most sensible one of all.
Yes, she was.
Isn't that interesting?
She was a little thief.
No, she was being practical.
She was being very practical.
First, she knocked on the door.
Mm-hmm.
Then she looked in the window when she saw no one. Then, you know, she didn't just break windows, you know.
But in the 2 or 3 days this book takes place, and she had no reason to believe there was anything catastrophic that happened.
Well she experienced that noise, too.
She heard the noise.
And she knew how freaked out all the adults were and not...
Yeah, the idea that she didn't know anything was wrong.
No TV was a big deal.
It must have been.
But she did find a PlayStation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think she knew a lot more than the adults gave her credit for.
Mm. Well, so does the author, because I marked this spot in the book. Rose knew what the noise was, but no one had asked her. It was the sound of fact. It was the change they'd pretended not to know was coming. It was the end of one life, but it was also the beginning of another kind of life. Rose kept walking. Rose was a survivor and would survive. She knew by some instinct, maybe just the human connection, that she was in the minority. And it goes on to tell her story. But I kind of love that she was the one.
She knew what had happened, but no one asked her.
Right. Right.
She could have volunteered some of the information, too.
But isn't that just like a kid, though?
Yeah.
Like, well,
yeah.
But
how could nobody
she,
asked
you
me.
You didn't ask me.
How could she have known what had happened?
Well, it doesn't mean she knew exactly. It means she knew that it was the apocalypse,
yeah,
as opposed
she knew.
To she knew that this country did this.
How would she know?
By intuition,
yeah,
I think.
That's interesting you said boom. Is that what you pictured the sound to be?
Well, if it travels from New York City out to the Hamptons, it'll be like thunder.
Yeah. Did it say that it traveled from New York City? I'm not sure.
It just say
was
anything.
Noise.
No.
I didn't picture boom. I pictured
this is his version.
Yeah. That's okay. I like a Rimsky version.
What did you figure?
I don't know. I thought again, you know, my brain went fantasy. It really did. I pictured just like this all encompassing noise, tone. I was picturing tone more than bang, where everyone was so startled by it. I thought other. Mm. I thought unexplainable.
Because the author called it a noise.
A noise.
Yeah.
He didn't call it a crack.
No.
Yeah.
He didn't call it a boom. No.
He didn't call it a boom.
No.
And noise seems kind of so benign.
Yeah.
But you can't define a noise. How can you define Beethoven?
The author didn't say it was a big noise. It was,
It was an
although we knew it was big enough to crack glass.
Yeah, he didn't say like the earth moved, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Did he? Did the water in the pool slosh around?
I don't remember.
I don't think so. Except for when the flamingos were in there.
That was so weird. Well, the last paragraph of the book is about Rose. She'd go back. She'd probably been missed already and felt a little guilty over not leaving a note. But she'd show them her bag, the things she'd found, tell them about the house in the woods with the DVD player and the three nice bedrooms and the camping supplies in the basement and the pantry lined with cans. She was only a girl, but the world still held something, and that mattered. Maybe her parents would cry over what they didn't know and what they did, which is that they were together. Maybe Ruth would empty the dishwasher, and G.H. would take out the garbage, and maybe the day would truly begin. And if the rest of it, something for lunch, a relaxing swim, those pool floats, catching up on a magazine, attempting that jigsaw puzzle, was unclear, so be it. If they didn't know how it would end, with night, with more terrible noise from the top of Olympus, with bombs, with disease, with blood, with happiness, with deer, or something else watching them from the darkened woods. Well, wasn't that true of every day? So she didn't care what the cause was. She knew that the world was different now, and she was going to be practical about filling up her bag.
Yeah. I find that very unsatisfying. I mean, what happens in 2 months when all those cans are empty? And
oh, yeah, of course.
Mm. Grr.
Hence the unsettled feeling.
Yeah.
With this book.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But sometimes, it stayed with me, like you said. And I would ask my husband, well, what would you do? Would you like to stay in the cabin or would you go back into the city? And I don't know if he answered me or not. He was like, oh, no, what's going on? So, but I wondered. I think I would want to nest, hunker down. If I had my family, I'm fine. Just stay in. But I don't know.
And I think they made a point that their apartment in the city was high up, right?
Yes, they did.
14th floors.
Yes, they couldn't possibly walk up.
That was Ruth's and George's apartment.
Yeah.
Oh, that was Ruth and George's.
Yeah.
Right, so they couldn't walk up the stairs because the power was out.
Okay.
They would have had to walk up the stairs.
So the family presumably could have gone back.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What I would have done, macho survivalist, is would have made sure everybody had a secure place, had water, had food, and would have gotten in the car, and I would have started driving west to see what I could find.
Mm.
Again, it's kind of a... It annoyed me, because that part of Long Island is not that easy to get lost in.
Mm.
You know, you're going to go... There are three main roads in Long Island.
Don't be so literal.
Well, no. This is what I would do. I would be practical.
Well, I would worry about how much gas was in the tank. That would be my only hesitation about them going into town to, you know... Is that what we want to use our gas for? Because this is probably our last tank of gas.
They didn't ask that question.
No, they didn't.
No, that's interesting.
They didn't.
I did like the fact that Ruth was disgusted by the dishes in her sink.
Yeah. It's easier to have guests rent your house when you're not there to see that they leave dishes in the sink.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what a couple of reviewers thought of this book. I think they liked it better than some of you did. The reviewer from the New York Times talked about Alam and said he's gifted with an acidic wit, one he uses to break down contemporary life at the cellular level. But as far as this book in particular, the adults cling to the cabin, but the children disappear into the encroaching wild. Alam doesn't dwell on the specificity of apocalypse, which has been the obsession of writers since the flood. Instead, he lobs a prescient accusation. Faced with the end of the world, you wouldn't do a damn thing. Terror is the inability to stop forces of nature, to protect the ones you love, and to protect even yourself. In Alam's purview, the flimsy and useless body. This reviewer calls his narrative both beautiful and unbearable. Leave the World Behind teeters on that seesaw edge question in horror fiction, to reveal the monster or not. Ultimately, it totters too far to one side, but there is still the primal, nail-biting need to know what the hell is going on. This propulsion, which drives much of the character's decisions, likewise drives the reader onward to a breathless conclusion that, if not altogether satisfying, is undeniably haunting. I thought that was a pretty good way of describing it. The author, the reviewer from NPR said, Leave the World Behind is a slippery and duplicitous marvel of a novel. And, talking about Clay and Amanda, they are securely middle-class, white, liberal couple, which means they're the quintessential soft target for satire. And Alam merrily proceeds to peel away their self-delusions in the opening section of the novel. His wit takes on an explicitly socially conscious dimension when the black couple in their 60s knocks on the door late on the second night of the family's vacation stay. Alam describes George, who goes by his initials, G.H., standing, holding up his hands in a gesture that was either conciliatory or said, don't shoot. By his age, black men were adept at this gesture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
George's wife, Ruth looked like the kind of woman you'd see in a television ad for an osteoporosis medication.
And you know exactly what he means when he says that.
What Alam does in this novel, this particular house of fiction, is to quietly remove the retaining walls he's erected in the first third of the story, so that by the end, readers step out into the terror of empty space without understanding how that happened. Leave the World Behind is atmospheric and prescient. Its rhythms of comedy alternating with shock and despair mimic so much of the rhythms of life right now. That's more than enough to make it a signature novel for this blasted year, which was the year 2020.
He wrote
this before the COVID pandemic, but that's when it came out.
Wow.
And so that's when reviewers were reading it. Anyway.
Are you sure Clay wasn't reviewing his own the book for the New York Times? Remember, Clay had a review to get into the New York Times.
Oh, that's right. He wanted to get an article in that he had written.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Well, I was glad to read it, and I decided, especially since we had an extra week because of the snowstorm last week, I decided to check out another book by the same author. And I read another book called Entitlement, and I did not care for it. The premise is that on that one is a young 20-something, no, maybe she's older 20s, 30, black woman, gets fed up with her teaching job, and she takes a job working for a wealthy philanthropist who's giving away all his money. And he has a little office of people who are helping him do that. And so she's taken on to work in this office, and she becomes just entranced, or I don't know, the idea of all this money, her glimpse of what this world is like, you know, seeing him spend $800,000 on a painting for his wife's birthday, you know, seeing this rarefied 1% of wealth, and she just is sucked in. She just really wants it. She starts justifying to herself why she's using the company credit card or the company card to dress appropriately for this kind of job. So she starts charging clothes, and she starts taking her friends out for a fancy meal, and she's just enticed by the whole thing. And she really misreads the relationship she has with this older, white, wealthy, married man, who's kind of taken by this kind of charmingly naive young woman.
Completely.
Yeah. So it's, but talk about not liking the characters. I didn't really like these characters, and I could see, you know, her going down the tubes early on.
Does it end badly?
Yeah, it ends bad.
Okay.
I'm going to stop our discussion now because I want to tell people about what's coming up next. Speaking Volumes is broadcast live on the first Tuesday of the month, except when there's a snowstorm. I'm sorry of you people that were expecting us last Tuesday. It's repeated each Tuesday at 6 and Wednesdays at midnight. If you'd like to get a monthly email reminder before each broadcast, please send an email to info@audiojournal.org. So next month, April 7th, Everything in Its Place, First Loves and Last Tales by Oliver Sacks. May 5th, Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fanny Flagg. June 2nd, Nothing to See Here by Kevin Wilson. We love hearing from our listeners, so if you have a book recommendation to pass along, or a comment about the book we're discussing next, you can call the office at 508-752-0557. You can also email us at info@audiojournal.org. So our book next month, April 7th, Everything in Its Place, First Loves and Last Tales by Oliver Sacks. In this volume, Oliver Sacks examines the many passions that defined his life, both as a doctor engaged in the central questions of human existence and as a polymath conversant in all the sciences. Everything in Its Place brings together writings on a rich variety of topics. Why do humans need gardens? How and when does a physician tell his patient she has Alzheimer's? What is social media doing to our brains? In several of the compassionate case histories included here, we see Sacks consider the enigmas of depression, psychosis, and schizophrenia for the first time. In others, he returns to conditions that have long fascinated him: Tourette syndrome, aging, dementia, and hallucinations. In counterpoint to these elegant investigations of what makes us human, this volume also includes pieces that celebrate Sacks' love of the natural world and his final meditations on life in the 21st century. It's his last book. He's passed away now. I just started reading it today. It's kind of a collection of writings. I think we'll enjoy talking about it. Speaking Volumes has been a production of Audio Journal. Our program has been archived and can be easily accessed by visiting our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. Thanks very much to Susan and Steve Robsky, to Carla McCullough, to Stacy Lanier. My name is Carol Sarafkhan. I hope you'll join us next month. Happy reading.
Birds in the subtropics of the Andes Mountains have to be creative to get their share of food from the forest. To outsip their competition, sword-billed hummingbirds have a distinct adaptation. These birds' beaks are longer than their bodies. Found in the temperate forests from Venezuela to Bolivia, these hummingbirds have co-evolved with various flower species to create a niche food source. They rely entirely on tube-like flowers that other species could never reach. While their sword-like beaks are handy for reaching a snack undisturbed by others, a beak that long doesn't come without challenges. For one thing, it's difficult to keep clean. The solution? Sliding it back and forth against tree branches, like a knight sharpening their blade. Then there's the problem of cleaning their feathers. Most birds can easily use their tongues, since they don't have a big, awkward beak to get in the way. Instead, sword-billed hummingbirds put their flexibility to the test and clean themselves with a good old scratch from their legs. So one big adaptation leads to new challenges. But these clever birds are up to the job. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.